The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. For most modern pet owners, dogs represent companionship, loyalty, and love. But throughout history, man's best friend has also been associated with our conceptions of death. You've probably seen images of Anubis, the jackal-headed Egyptian god of embalming and funerals, or heard of Cerberus, the three-headed hound that guarded the gates of hell in Greek mythology. Fast forward to today, where cadaver dogs are specially trained to locate human remains. Kat Warren is a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science, journalism, and creative nonfiction. She's also a cadaver dog handler, and her new book is called What the Dog Knows. And Kat, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Taylor. It's really delightful.
Of course. So I mentioned Anubis in the introduction, but we were really stunned to find that dogs weren't just symbols. You write that the Zoroastrians actually used dogs in their funerary rites. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Zoroastrians are a kind of interesting case because very early on, they integrated dogs into almost every aspect of their lives. And so, you know, they had the herding dogs. They had something called house dogs, which were kind of the equivalent of our lap dogs. And then they had these dogs called Sogdid. And what the Sogdid dog did was that it drove away the demons that might otherwise inhabit people's bodies, and which was a great fear. And what the Zoroastrians realized is that dogs could be around dead bodies and even, let's say, eat dead bodies without these demon gods coming after them. And so there was that kind of like, well, let's take advantage of this. And so they created these dogs that were specifically brought in to stand by the corpse and gaze on it and drive away the demons that might otherwise inhabit that loved one.
Were these special breeds of dogs? Were they specific colors? What set them apart?
An archaeologist sent me a beautiful little bronze figurine of what they thought a Sogdid dog was, and it looked exactly like a German Shepherd, which pleased me utterly because, since I have two of them. But one of the things that they had to be was reasonably young male, and then that they would have quote-unquote four eyes. And what they meant by that is that these are the dogs that had little color patches above their eyes.
Oh, like little spots.
Little spots. And, you know, many of the herding breeds are, if you think about shepherds or even Rottweilers or other kinds of dogs, you know that those two-tone dogs are very often either in working or herding breeds. And those were the rules for these dogs that would come in and essentially protect corpses.
What is it about guarding the dead that people associate with a dog? Why a dog and why not some other type of animal?
Well, you know, it's so interesting to go back to the history of the dog, but we do know that early on, dogs were used to help dispose of bodies because dogs would eat people. And so when you had early civilizations and you would put the dead outside the gates of a city, for instance, the dogs would help take care of that. And it's that notion that if dogs can do this and not suffer from it, then they must have special powers. You know,
you mean because so many other animals, or because humans, of course, would get terribly sick and
Exactly. And, you know, humans had so much fear around death, and to see the kind of impunity with which dogs enjoyed themselves around corpses, it was like, let's turn what could be considered a negative into a positive.
Well, you did mention that you have two German Shepherds, is that right?
I do.
Two German Shepherds. And I know from the book that one of them is a cadaver dog, but I guess I was surprised to find that you sort of fell into being a cadaver dog handler. It's not something that you necessarily planned on. Can you talk a little bit about what led you to train your German Shepherd to become a cadaver dog?
Yeah, because as one trainer said, he was a jackass. We had this
a technical term.
We had a German Shepherd pup, and I was expecting my husband had fallen in love with shepherds, and we were expecting a pretty quiet, low key, obedient, loyal dog. And Solo was several of those things, but he was also really a little hellion. He was a singleton, which meant that he had been the only pup in his litter, and that meant that he was essentially emotionally stunted around other dogs. He could not sort of read their language. And that's the way dogs get in trouble. So a lot of singletons happen to be dog aggressive. And Solo was, as a pup. We were just at the end of our ropes, and I took him to a trainer whom I respected greatly. And it was she who said, "Why don't you make him into a cadaver dog?" And so that's what happened. By the time he was two, I started training, was invited to train with a local police canine unit by their sergeant, with whom I still train today. And
let's talk a little bit about the work and about the training. I mean, how does one train a cadaver dog, especially, I sort of think about what you said earlier, how does one prevent it from eating what it discovers? I mean, that's morbid.
Well,
but
it's morbid, but it's realistic. I mean, let's face it, humans are mammals, and we all know the delight with which some dogs go out in the woods and find a dead deer or a dead squirrel.
Sure, and we wouldn't we wouldn't be surprised if
we wouldn't be that shocked. I mean, we might be a little repulsed from the smell whatever, but it's sort of like, yeah. And so you train them essentially by distracting them. If there are dogs that have a tendency to say, "Oh gosh, this smells good." Solo is not one of those dogs, but what you're immediately doing is getting them more interested in their toy, or even for some dogs, a liver treat, and that sense of I really want to consume this goes away very fast.
So what else goes into the training of a cadaver dog?
So one of the things that you have to do early on is teach the dog what that scent is. And what's interesting about cadaver scent is we still don't know a lot about it. We know that it's one of the most complex scents other than live human scent. Arpad Voss, who's a forensic anthropologist, has identified 480 different volatile compounds coming off of decomposing human bodies. That's a lot.
Kind of
I know. He thinks that once his DOA, which stands for Decomposition Odor Analysis Database, is done, he thinks it'll be closer to 1,000 compounds. And so what you're doing is you're telling the dog that all of these different scents and various combinations of them all are the thing they're looking for.
I'm speaking with Kat Warren. She's a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science journalism and creative nonfiction. Her new book is What the Dog Knows, and she's also a cadaver dog handler. Her dog Solo just retired after 9 years as a cadaver dog. Now, do cadaver dogs need to have like especially good noses? I mean, are they known for being able to sniff out anything?
Lots of dogs have very good noses, and cadaver dogs have very good noses. It's not really relevant what the breed is. What you want is a dog that wants to work, has the ability to sort of ignore lots of distractions. Some of that happens in training. And then just like you can train a drug dog to find different kinds of narcotics, you can train a cadaver dog to find different stages that humans can go through as they decompose. So as you can well imagine, you might have somebody who is very recently missing, up to really ancient bones. We have evidence that dogs have been very good at helping locate bones from the old Mississippi Delta civilizations, the mound people.
But I typically think of bloodhounds as being a dog that's really used to sniff out. You know, it's I guess maybe it's a movie trope, but you know, you show them a piece of fabric and they can trace anything and anybody to any location. But it doesn't seem like bloodhounds would be the go-to cadaver dog.
Well, the process is a little different with a tracking or trailing dog. It's that classic trope, as you said, where you show them something to sniff that belonged to that person and then tell them to go find that person, and they're following the trail of that person. With cadaver dogs or with drug dogs, what those dogs are doing is they're trying to find in the air a scent. So they're basically quartering back and forth to find that scent. And you'll also see that if you see dogs working on a disaster scene, right, they're not following a trail. They're going up on that rubble and they're trying to find a hint of live human and in some cases dead human. And so they're simply going around these rubble piles looking for that scent because there's nothing to track. So once they hit that scent, what they're going to do is they're going to go down to where that scent is most concentrated. And ideally, you'll have a live victim who can be saved by that.
Right.
Sadly, in some cases, it also helps find somebody who's deceased.
You know, I think it would be obvious to anybody that a human being working in those sorts of conditions is going to be liable to feel some trauma, you know, that there can be some real emotional distress associated with that kind of rescue operation. Do you know at all if dogs, if rescue dogs or cadaver dogs, feel the sort of weight of those situations?
So it's a complicated answer. Mm. In principle, no, because if you have a cadaver dog, you are training them to feel utter joy when they find the dead because they're going to get the reward that they're waiting
right,
for.
The toy, right? Or the treat, yeah.
That, exactly. So a well-trained dog does not say, oh my God, I've just found somebody dead. This is so upsetting. That said, if you have a dog that we call a live find dog, and it's put into a situation, and this certainly happened in 9/11, where they're not finding live victims. It can be upsetting for the handler and for the dog. So some of the discussion that came about saying that the dogs got depressed when they found somebody who was dead, it wasn't so much that, it was that dogs were being used in situations where it just wasn't in their training to be finding what they found.
You know, we think of these dogs that do work, whether it's finding cadavers or other types of service. You know, we think about it a lot of times in terms of the benefit that it provides to us. But I wonder, you know, does it provide a benefit to the dog? Did Solo really benefit from his life as a cadaver dog?
You know, I could ask him, and I don't know what he would say.
He's not there in the studio with you, is he?
You know, he's not in the studio. He loved training. He loved going on searches. And I think that several things happened. First of all, it opened up a world to him that might have been more narrow given his issues with other dogs if I hadn't discovered this work. But it gave him enormous freedom and a lot of area to stretch his legs and his brain, right? The other thing it did is that there's some evidence that working dogs actually have longer and healthier lives. There's some early research that people are starting to do, like Cindy Otto down up at Penn, about the fact that working dogs are pretty happy dogs. They're very physically fit. They are, for the most part, not obese. And they get out a lot, and they get to think and work. And for many dogs, that's a pretty happy thing.
Well, Kat, thank you so much for joining us today. It was really, really fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate being invited.
Kat Warren is a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science journalism and creative nonfiction. Her book, What the Dog Knows, is now out in paperback. And you can find a link to more information at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from corpse-sniffing dogs to mountain-climbing pups. Up next, we'll hear from a blind hiker who summited all of New Hampshire's 4,000 footers with the help of a guide dog. And that story's coming up after a break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. More than a million Americans are legally blind, and when they hike and run, most prefer to pair up with a human guide, which, unlike guide dogs, can give instructions verbally and explain obstacles at a quick pace. A handful of blind runners and hikers do prefer to work with dogs, though, and Ariel Zions brings us this story.
Watch the tree, right? Watch the tree. I know you're all fired up. She's so excited about snow. She's not doing her job real well right now. Autumn, heel. I need your focus. Ready? Work.
That's Randy ready? Pierce talking to his new guide dog, Autumn. They're getting ready to hike to the summit of Pack Monadnock, a mountain in southern New Hampshire. This was only Autumn's fifth hike and her first in the snow. Autumn is Randy's third guide dog. He's had her for 8 months, and it will take about a year for the pair to be totally in sync with each other.
To go from a guide dog, you've worked 8 years together. You know everything that you want to do together. You know how to communicate, and you just are smooth and fluid together. To a new dog who doesn't know any of your habits, listens differently, has different motivations, and you have to learn to understand them and build that relationship over again. It's a lot of work to get back to where you were before.
Here's how a guide dog team works. Autumn wears a harness and walks to Randy's left. She guides him around obstacles like trees, signs, and potholes. But sometimes there are obstacles that you can't just walk around. If Autumn comes across a big step, road, or river crossing, she stops. It is then up to Randy to figure out what he is facing and how to get around it. The more they hike together, the better Autumn will become at judging and communicating the presence of an obstacle. They will eventually be able to hike faster, and Randy won't trip or hit obstacles as often. Randy hasn't always had to hike with a guide dog. He was born sighted, but lost most of his vision when he was 22. It happened over a period of 2 weeks. His optic nerves deteriorated. He was left with narrow tunnel vision in one eye and became totally blind in the other.
I didn't know anything about blindness, really, at that point, but you begin to learn. First off, I learned that I'm not going to be able to drive that brand new car I just bought.
11 years later, Randy was riding the bus with Austin, his first guide dog. The dog placed his head on Randy's lap, and using the narrow tunnel vision in his left eye, Randy looked down at Austin.
And I saw this beautiful face looking up at me with love, adoration, concern, and then it closed out. And that's the last thing I ever saw.
At that moment, Randy became completely blind.
Think about how wonderful. If you've got to have a last image, you know, I could have been watching a commercial, but I was looking at a loving face, and that's what I get to keep with me forever.
In 2005, Austin passed away from a tumor in his heart. Randy was then matched with a new guide dog, the Mighty Quinn.
I walked so much and got so good at all the basics, and Quinn loved the woods so much, I said, you know what? I wonder how he'd handle going back out, because I wanted to try a mountain. Because mountains are synonymous with challenge, and I love that notion.
Dogs are better than human guides at maneuvering through tight trails, and when it comes to snow and ice, they are often the safer choice. Dogs tend to slip less, which means Randy won't go down with them. But most importantly, dogs give Randy a greater sense of independence.
You get this feeling of pride and personal accomplishment when you do it together as a guide dog team and handler. When I add another person in, well, I'm proud of what they and I are doing together, but it takes a little bit away from my feeling of my self-accomplishment. And while we're dependent on the dog, you build so much of a bond that you're sort of a little bit of one and the same.
Randy's greatest hiking accomplishment so far is summiting New Hampshire's 48 peaks over 4,000 feet in a single winter season. Soon after helping Randy achieve that goal, Quinn was diagnosed with bone cancer. And in January 2014, Randy said goodbye to a guide dog for the second time.
When he was playing, he didn't feel the pain. And we must have played all morning as much as he could before heading into the vets to say goodbye to him. And then my wife and I both, we cradled him in our arms. And I told him how proud I was of him. How lucky I was to have such an amazing boy. Both whispered our love to him. We held him while he took his last big heavy sigh of breath.
Quinn was well known around New Hampshire. The media covered the team's accomplishments, and Randy regularly speaks at schools. So when Quinn passed away, a whole community grieved. Hundreds of people sent condolences through the mail and commented in online obituaries. Some people even made fan art. A favorite is a photoshopped image. With his white wings, the mighty Quinn is leaping towards heaven from a snowy mountain summit. I asked Randy if his feelings of independence and accomplishment are worth the difficulty of the cycle he goes through, training and bonding with the dog, working together, saying goodbye, getting a new dog, repeat.
All the pain and the grief and the loss and the anger sometimes during that, that's horrible. But over time, you learn it's more about the choice to celebrate all of the wonderful experiences you had, and all of those experiences that are possible are well worth every bit of that pain. It won't lessen that pain any.
Randy's new dog, Autumn, is not as accurate and fast as the mighty Quinn, at least not yet. With Quinn, Randy could hike Pat Monadnock in 30 minutes, but with Autumn, it took him around an hour.
In the start of our hike, it showed that she was more distracting. I had to build my trust, and I had to kind of hold her back and teach her a little bit. And about halfway up, she really hit a nice stride, and we were going well. And then as we got near the top, she got a little tired.
Randy is confident Autumn will improve. This is good news, because in the spring, Randy will run the Boston Marathon. And next fall, he plans to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Randy will be using human guides for those adventures, but will have to train. And for that, Autumn will be by his side. For Salt Radio, I'm Arielle Zients.
Goodbye, speedometer. Hello, connected car. Up next, we'll hear about a digital studio with a bold new approach to designing the car dashboard. Stick around.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Cars have changed a lot in the past few decades, but a big part of today's supercharged vehicle remains surprisingly familiar. The dashboard. Yeah, sure, they look a little slicker, but modern dashboards still feature the same basic stuff. There's a speedometer, a gas gauge, a volume knob, and so on. But what if our dashboards were radically redesigned? Us2 is a digital studio best known for creating the best-selling Monument Valley, an Escher-esque puzzle game that won Apple's iPad Game of the Year in 2014. But they're also interested in reimagining the car dashboard. Their recent ebook called Are We There Yet? Thoughts on In-Car HMI is available for free online, and I'm joined now by two of the authors. First, Harsha Vardhan, who specializes in interaction and service design at Us2. And Harsha, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, Taylor.
And also with us is Us2's Tim Smith, who specializes in visual design and user interfaces. Hi, Tim. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
So, Tim, I want to start with you and one of your complaints, actually. Okay. You say a lot of modern in-car interfaces are, generally speaking, unapproachable. And I'm wondering, what do you mean by that, and why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's a few different kind of visual cues immediately that kind of stick out like a sore thumb, and that's the kind of the dark, what we call Tron-like nature of these HMIs. By that, I mean they're kind of neon blue aesthetics on a dark background, often with these metallic textures. And that kind of denotes qualities of kind of masculinity and, you know, almost sci-fi futuristic, which I think fundamentally are quite daunting and unfriendly, cold emotions that this piece of interactive is giving off. And that's the opposite of what we like to do as to. It's supposed to be very approachable, friendly, and by making them those two things, it becomes much more usable and intuitive.
I was really struck by something that you put in the book, that automakers use the sort of stick a touch screen on it strategy when it comes to the instrument panels and dashboards, which, you know, I mean, I guess it's cool, but at the same time, maybe it's not enough.
It's one of the first steps, I think, at putting a screen into a car. You assume, you know, it's this touchscreen is working well for tablets and smartphones. Let's just port that into the car. That would be a very obvious solution. But I think that's not considering the context. It's easy to port something that's successfully working in a smartphone. You put it into a new context of the car and things don't quite work. You're driving 50 miles an hour along a motorway. You can't be doing certain things which require too much cognitive load. Whereas if you're, you know, walking down the street at your leisurely pace, you know, looking for the nearest restaurant, that's something which you can, you know, devote more what we call cognitive load or attention to. Whereas you want the driver's eyes and attention on the road, you know, 100% if you can. And so this slap a touch screen on it is really just a quiet distraction.
Yeah, this is really an issue of safety. You know, we have so much information that we sort of want to pack in our cars, and once you put all of that in there, it can be a little dangerous for a driver who's not sure where to look.
Car manufacturers are kind of, they're one-upping each other, something that we call featureitis, cramming in more and more features into this HMI in order to, you know, make sure that their feature list is as rich or as compelling to a customer, whereas it's, you know, actually in the car that just gets more and more destructive and you know, potentially less safe.
And HMI stands for Human Machine Interface, for listeners who don't know. You know, in the book, there's a great side-by-side shot comparing the instrument panel of a 1970 Mercedes SL against a 2013 car of the same make and model. Harsha, I've got to say, just looking at it sort of made me think that there was a certain simplicity in the older version that looked really appealing. And I wonder if that's something that you thought of when you were writing this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a classic example of featureitis. It works very well for airline pilots. It works very well for medical personnel who need to have this, you know, fine-grained control over every bit of the car. But when it comes to a normal user or a normal driver or a normal passenger, I mean, it's not needed. And what is needed is, you know, a focus on the road and as little distraction as possible. You know, so we need to balance out, you know, which features are most important versus putting everything up on there.
I'm talking about the design of the dashboard and the instrument panel with two designers, Tim Smith and Harsha Vardham, both from a company called Us2, creators of the video game Monument Valley. And Tim and Harsha are two of several authors on Us2's new ebook called Are We There Yet? Thoughts on In-Car HMI. Tim, I want to talk about sort of the look specifically of some of these instruments. And the look of the speedometer fascinates me. It's always been pretty much the same. You've got a round gauge with a needle that, you know, pushes clockwise the faster you go. It was, you know, it served a very specific purpose once upon a time. Can you tell me a little bit about that and then how it might look if we were to free ourselves from this legacy concept of what it's supposed to look like?
So as far as we're aware, it comes from like a mechanical legacy. So there was a cable connecting the engine to a cable connecting the engine to the needle, and it was effectively pulling on it, depending on the level of force you applied to it. But throughout the process of writing the book, we did ask ourselves, you know, if you were to forget the past, forget the legacy of the car. If the car was invented now and we had to have something in the dash that represented how fast you were going, would a needle pointing at a number in an array, a circular array, would that be the way we design it? I'm not 100% convinced that that is the case. What we decided to do, rather than have a kind of a permanent 0 to 200, for example, what we could do instead is just plot your speed against what the speed limit is on the current road that you're driving. And one way we imagined that was kind of a screen that's filled with color. If there was no color, you're going 0 miles an hour. If the screen was filled with a piece of color, like a bar chart, then you're at the top of the speed limit and anywhere in between. One of our philosophies was insight, not information. And with this mechanic, it will just tell you at a glance you are near or over the speed limit.
Harsha, you know, as I was reading this book, I couldn't help but think about, you know, the future of the car maybe being a car that drives itself, that we don't have to worry so much about the instrument panel distracting us. And I was thinking especially about something like voice commands. You know, do you think that down the road, maybe we'd be able to do away with all of these dashboard and instrument conventions and just rely on something like iPhone Siri to do voice commands when we want to change something or we want to do something differently on the road?
Yeah, it might. But the problem is in things like voice, You know, it's not perfect. And there are some, you know, critical challenges with voice, because there's something called the orientation response, which people face in cars nowadays, where you're driving along and when your car responds or your dashboard responds saying, okay, so where do you want to go? And you speak to it. You don't speak to it in ether, but you actually turn towards the HMI as it was a person. And this is a kind of a social construct where we turn our heads and actually try to listen and actually try to respond to something. And actually try to speak to the interface.
So what are you saying? Are you saying that a voice command and sometimes maybe is just as distracting as actually, you know, looking down and manually finding something on your phone?
Not really. Not really. I mean, so a voice command is good for, you know, switching things on and off, for instance. But it does not have the same kind of control when you have analog inputs, like, say, increase the volume to 60%. And if you have a knob for that, it's much easier because it's just muscle memory. You don't even need to look. You need to just get there and turn it by your hand. So it has to be a balance between both physical and non-physical controls.
So what's the end game for an ebook like this? Are you hoping to inspire automakers to maybe do something differently, you know, innovate on the dashboard? Or is it to actually be able to do it yourselves to sort of, you know, prove that you've got what it takes?
It's both. It's a bit of both. And essentially, it's about, you know, actually inspiring the automotive field to think beyond what they've actually been doing as part of a convention, as part of legacy. And this, it's not just the automakers, it's to inspire other designers to actually question the status quo and giving them the tools to do so.
Tim Smith, Harsha Vardham, designers at Us2. There's a link to their ebook on in-car HMI and a trailer for the video game Monument Valley. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. And Tim and Harsha, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Taylor. It was nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
Okay, if all of that was a bit confusing, here's the TLDR version. All of the stuff in your car, the dashboard, the controls, all the pedals and lights and knobs, it shouldn't be so hard to use. Well, just like the guys at Us2, Roman Mars is all about design. He's the host of the podcast 99% Invisible. And in this next piece, he discovers a weird problem with one of the most intuitive aspects of our vehicles, the steering wheel.
If I asked you to close your eyes and mimic the action of using one of the simple human interfaces in everyday life, you could probably do it, no problem. Without having a button to push, you could close your eyes and pretend to push a button, and that action would accurately reflect the action of pushing a real button. Same with flipping a switch or turning a doorknob. If you close your eyes and fake the movement, it would sync up with its real-world use. Now, if I asked you to do the same thing with a car's steering wheel, you'd think you'd be able to describe steering accurately and mime the correct movements with your hands in the air. But you'd be wrong, so wrong. You'd probably kill a bunch of imaginary people. But don't just take my word for it.
Yeah, my name is Steve. I'm a human factors engineer.
His full name is Dr. Steve Clote. He just introduces himself as Steve. He's a casual guy.
And what was your research on? What's your main research you've done?
And that's Tristan Cook, and Thomas Nelson is also in the room there asking questions of Steve. Tristan and Tom run this awesome blog called Humans in Design.
My interests are in driver behavior.
So here's the exercise. Put your hands up and grip an imaginary steering wheel, 10 and 2.
So I've got my hands at 10 and 2.
10 and 2.
Yep.
Now I want you to mime the action of changing lanes to the right. So have you tried it? All right, if you're like most people, and according to Steve's research, we're talking the vast majority of people, you turned your imaginary wheel 45 degrees to the right or so, and then back to the center. And that's the action for changing lanes. But that's not right.
What you've described is actually a sequence of movements that you require for turning a corner.
To actually change lanes, you have to turn the steering wheel to the right, then turn it back, crossing the center line, turning the wheel an equal amplitude to the left to correct your heading, and then back to the center. Knowing that this weird brain hiccup existed, Steve's team at the University of Queensland tested people in driving simulators. And sure enough, if you provided visual feedback, people could change lanes no problem. But as soon as you turned off the screen or blindfolded them and told them to change lanes, even though they had only just moments ago successfully performed the correct action, they couldn't do it.
They produced pretty catastrophic errors.
Given no other feedback, you can't change lanes using a steering wheel without vision. I mean, since cars are designed to be driven with your eyes open, that's okay. And in fact, this is a funky example. That doesn't mean that a steering wheel is a bad interface design. You could probably argue the opposite. You could argue that a steering wheel is so well designed that anyone can use it with just a little bit of feedback in the real world, even though they can't describe how they use it in the abstract.
So people didn't learn, they just did just the same.
But over the course of an experiment, which takes about 45 minutes to an hour, the size of the error was pretty consistent.
But Steve and his researchers decided to test this in a real car. So Steve got something like $50 million worth of insurance and took people out in a real car and drove them down a test road and then took their vision away and asked them to change lanes. Our friends Tristan and Tom were two of the participants.
The first time you took vision away from me, it was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like when Obi-Wan Kenobi was teaching Luke Skywalker how to use a lightsaber without using his eyes.
With the blast shield down, I can't even see.
In the first few runs, people made the same mistake they did in the simulator. Essentially, they were told to change lanes, and they moved the steering wheel in such a way that they turned a corner instead. But here's where things get really interesting.
Stretch out with your feelings.
People gradually started to improve, and by the end of the real-world blind trial, they were performing almost perfect lane changes.
See? You can do it.
I call it luck.
In my experience, there's no such thing as luck.
When you're driving a car, you have a whole bunch of extra visual information that you can use to supplement vision.
There's the vestibular system that senses your balance, or the somatosensory system that senses pressure on your skin as your thigh presses into the seat as you turn a corner.
One gives an erroneous signal, The others would correct it.
Well, that's right.
Using all those extra senses, people learned how to perform the lane change in a real car, blindfolded. But here's the crazy part. After it was over, they asked the participants to mime a lane change with an imaginary steering wheel in their hands. And sure enough, they went right back to making the same mistake, performing a corner turn instead of a lane change.
Just how robust this error was, and how it was resistant to learning.
The steering wheel is pretty nicely mapped to our intuition, but it still requires the slightest bit of feedback so that our brain knows how to use it. But we still manage. Also, I can't stress this enough, people. Don't drive blindfolded. Really, you're not going to be able to do it. All right, I'm glad we had this chat.
That was Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible. Coming up, we'll talk about redesigning something a whole lot different than a car dashboard or a steering wheel. When Word of Mouth continues, how scientists hope to combat dengue fever using genetically modified mosquitoes. That's coming up in just a minute.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. There are plenty of folks uncomfortable with the idea of consuming genetically modified foods, so it's no surprise that a planned experiment to release millions of genetically modified mosquitoes in Florida isn't a universally popular idea. British researchers are hoping to use the bugs in the fight against dengue fever and chikungunya, viral diseases spread by mosquito bites. And journalist for the Associated Press, Jennifer Kay, is here to talk more about the experiment. Jennifer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little bit about how these mosquitoes have been genetically modified. What's different about them?
What's different about these mosquitoes compared to the ones that you see out there in the world every summer up there in New Hampshire? These are mosquitoes that are specifically one kind of mosquito, the Aedes aegypti. It's a mosquito species that's known to carry diseases like the ones you just mentioned, dengue fever and chikungunya. And they are modified in a lab so that when the male mosquitoes are released, the male mosquitoes will mate with wild, regular mosquitoes out there in the Florida Keys. And then any offspring they produce will die off in the larvae stage. So the male mosquitoes carry an autocidal gene that will kill off the next generation of mosquitoes. And this will help reduce the number of wild Aedes aegypti mosquitoes in the Florida Keys.
Why are they only releasing males?
Because male mosquitoes don't bite. Male mosquitoes don't need the blood meal that female mosquitoes do because they're producing eggs and for the offspring.
Huh.
Male mosquitoes just eat nectar. They're basically carb lovers. They don't need the protein. So male mosquitoes aren't going to bite humans.
Now, that's the hope anyway. I mean, is there any risk that even a few of these females would be able to get out? I mean, it's just hard to imagine breeding millions of mosquitoes and maybe having it just 100% perfect experiment. You're never going to have any sort of flyaways.
Well, right. And Oxitec says that up front, that there might be a small statistical blip where some of the mosquitoes, the female mosquitoes, are modified and do get out of the lab. They are sorted by hand. It's not a machine that's releasing these. They do have lab workers who are going through and checking to make sure that the modified mosquitoes are mostly as close to 100% as possible being released. And Oxitec maintains that even if a few females do get out there, it'll be such a small percentage that it won't be any danger to people, and that even if a female modified mosquito bites anyone, there really isn't any danger of transmitting that material.
Is this the first experiment of its kind that they've run?
It's not the first experiment in the world. This would be the first time these mosquitoes would be released in the U.S. Oxitec has released these mosquitoes in small trials in the Cayman Islands, in Panama, in Brazil, and in Malaysia. And Oxitec says that they have had such great success, particularly in Brazil and the Cayman Islands, that those countries want them to come back and do larger tests.
Now, obviously, dengue fever is a big, big problem, but how big of a problem is it here in Florida? It seems kind of odd that there would be an experiment in Florida where, as far as I know, there haven't really been any outbreaks.
Well, we have had some outbreaks. It's something that is present. We do have a number of cases every year in Florida that are locally acquired. In 2009 and 2010, there were several dozen cases of dengue in the Florida Keys. And just last year, a community farther north along Florida's Atlantic coast also had an outbreak of a few dozen cases. So it is present here in Florida. And the worry is that we'll just keep seeing more as more people are coming to Florida. There's a concern that a warming climate makes the environment more hospitable to those mosquitoes.
So what's the reaction been? I mean, do people know that this might happen?
Yes. The Florida Keys Mosquito Control District and Oxitec have been very public and very open about their plans. They've had a number of public meetings over the several years that this test has been in the works. They're trying to get out and answer as many questions as people have. It seems like they keep running into the same questions over and over about how this works and what the risks are to the people who live there.
I wonder, as a reporter, if you read this, and do you get a sense of whether or not, you know, the risks posed by something like dengue fever outweigh the qualms that people may have and may always have when it comes to genetically modified organisms of any kind?
Yeah, I went to one of the public meetings that the Mosquito Control District and Oxitec had in November in Key West, in the neighborhood where they want to release these modified mosquitoes. Then I watched a video of the subsequent meeting that they had for the entire city. My impression was that people just hear genetically modified and then they stop listening. That's what they're afraid of. They're not necessarily afraid of dengue. They say, oh, well, we haven't had dengue in the Keys in 5 years. But health officials tell you that dengue fever and chikungunya are big concerns.
Now, if this is successful, first of all, if it gets permission and then they go ahead, see a great success, do you see this sort of tactic being adopted elsewhere in the United States, maybe to fight things like, you know, West Nile, which admittedly is not all that prevalent, but it's something that, you know, makes waves in the media whenever it comes at least to New Hampshire?
Well, the thing about mosquito control is that it's really interesting. There's a lot of different things going on out there. One program is a genetic modification that Oxitec does. There are other tests going on in the U.S. that would use a bacteria, injecting a kind of bacteria into the mosquitoes so that it's like the mosquito is carrying its own insecticide. We can just spray more chemicals at them, but you know, mosquitoes build resistance over time to different chemicals. Another problem in the Keys, they've concluded that 4 out of 6 chemicals approved to spray for the Aedes aegypti mosquito no longer are effective. There's a lot of different things that are happening out there this what's happening with Oxitec and the genetic modification, that's kind of one piece of this larger discussion about how to deal with mosquitoes that carry diseases.
Jennifer Kay is a reporter for the Associated Press and author of the article, Millions of GMO Insects Could Be Released in Florida Keys. You can imagine that headline being read several different ways. Jennifer Kay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You can find a link to that article on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for your listening time today. Lots more to check out at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can always catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.